This is Audible.
Scholastic Audio presents All the Crooked Saints by Maggie Stiefvater, read by Tom Rivera. Colorado, 1962. Chapter 1. You can hear a miracle a long way after dark. Miracles are very like radio waves in this way. Not many people realize that the ordinary radio wave and the extraordinary miracle have much in common. Left to their own devices, radio waves would not be audible for much more than 40 or 50 miles. They travel on perfectly straight paths from their broadcast source, and because the Earth is round, it does not take them long to part ways with the ground and head out to the stars. Wouldn't we all if we had the chance? What a shame that both miracles and radio waves are invisible, because it would be quite a sight. Ribbons of marvel and sound stretching out straight and true from all over the world. But not all radio waves and miracles escape unheard. Some bounce off the ceiling of the ionosphere, where helpful free electrons oscillate in joyful harmony with them, before thrusting them back to Earth at new angles. In this way, a signal can leap from Rosarito or Nogales, knock its head on the ionosphere, and find itself in Houston or Denver, stronger than ever. And if it is broadcast after sundown? Many things in this life work better without the sun's meddlesome attention, and this process is one of them. At night, radio waves and miracles can caper up and down so many times over that in some unpredictable cases, they eventually reach transmitters and saints thousands of miles away from their sources. In this way, a small miracle in tiny Bicho Raro might be heard all the way in Philadelphia, or vice versa. Is this science? Religion? It is difficult even for scientists and saints to tell the difference between the two. Perhaps it doesn't matter. When you cultivate invisible seeds, you can't expect everyone to agree on the shape of your invisible crops. It is wiser to simply acknowledge that they grow well together. On the night this story begins, both a saint and a scientist were listening to miracles. It was dark, true dark in the way it gets in the desert, and the three Soria cousins had gathered in the back of a box truck. Above them, the bigger stars had been pushing the smaller stars out of their heavenly home in a pretty little shower for about an hour. The sky beneath was pure black all the way down to the greasewood and rabbit brush that filled the valley. It was mostly quiet, except for the radio and the miracles. The truck was parked in a vast stretch of scrub, several miles from the nearest town. It wasn't really anything to look at, just a faded red 1958 Dodge moving truck with a somewhat optimistic expression. One taillight was fractured. The right front tire was ever so slightly flatter than the left. There was a stain on the passenger seat that would always smell like cherry coke. A little wooden alebrije that was part skunk and part coyote was strung up on the rearview mirror. The truck had Michigan plates, although this was not Michigan. The radio was playing, not the one in the cab, the one in the cargo area, a teal blue Motorola unit taken from Antonia Soria's kitchen counter. It was playing the Soria cousin's station, not the one they liked to listen to, the one they had created. The box truck was their broadcast studio on wheels. They. There. Really, it was Beatriz Soria's truck and Beatriz Soria's radio station. This is every Soria story, but it is hers more than anyone else's. Although it wasn't her voice playing over the AM radio waves, it was her complicated and wiry heart powering them. Other people have smiles and tears to show how they feel. Enigmatic Beatriz Soria had a box truck full of transmitters in the Colorado desert. If she cut herself, wherever she was, the speakers in the box truck bled. "If you're tired of singing only to swinging," the DJ promised, "you'll find us after the sun goes down, but before the sun comes up." This voice belonged to the youngest of the cousins, Joaquin. He was 16 years old, took himself very seriously, and preferred that you did as well. He was suave and clean-shaven, with headphones pressed against a single ear to avoid spoiling his hair, which he had oiled into an Elvis pompadour of considerable height. Two flashlights illuminated him like golden premature spotlights, leaving everything else in purple and blue and black. He wore the same shirt he had been wearing for 2 months. A short-sleeved red Hawaiian print number with the collar popped. He had seen a shirt worn similarly in the single film he had managed to see in 1961, and had vowed to recreate the look for himself. A garden of soda bottles filled with water grew by his feet. He had a phobia of dehydration, and to combat it, he always carried enough water to moisten him for days. After dark, he did not go by the name Joaquin Soria. In the mobile station that roamed the high alpine desert, he called himself Diablo Diablo. It was a DJ name that would have scandalized both his mother and grandmother had they known. Which was the point. Truth be told, it scandalized Joaquin himself a little. He enjoyed the thrill of danger each time he said it, superstitiously believing that if he whispered a third Diablo after the name, the devil might actually appear. Here was a thing Joaquin Soria wanted. To be famous. Here was a thing he feared. Dying alone in the parched dust outside Bicho Raro. "Some more of that dancing and dreaming," Diablo Diablo's voice continued. "The hottest sounds of 62, from Del Norte to Blanca and from Via Grove to Antonito. The music that'll save your soul." The other two cousins in the truck, Beatriz and Daniel, raised their eyebrows. This claim of covering the entire San Luis Valley was certainly fraudulent, but Joaquin's interests tended more toward things that would be nice if they were true, rather than things that actually were true. No, the station did not cover the valley. But what a kind place the world would be if it could. Daniel shifted position. The cousins were knee-to-knee in the back of the truck, and because of this cramped proximity, Daniel's long foot couldn't help but unsettle one of Joaquin's water bottles. The metal cap burst across the floor, skittering on its rim as if pursued. The wires on the floor shrank back from the water. Disaster whispered briefly. Then Joaquin snatched up the bottle and shook it at Daniel. "Don't break the truck," he said. "It's new." It was not new, but it was new to being a radio station. Before the truck had been pressed into its current role, it had been used by Ana Maria Soria's brother's wife's sister's family to transport the Alonso brothers from painting jobs to bars. The truck had grown weary of this tedium and had broken down, and since the Alonso brothers preferred painting and drinking to lifting the truck's spirits, it had been left to grow weeds. In fact, during this time, it had collected enough moisture for a crop of swamp timothy and sedges to grow fast and thick over its roof and hood, completely transforming the truck into a wetland in the middle of the desert. Animals came from miles to live in this oasis. First a beaver, then 12 leopard frogs with their creaking rocking chair calls, then 30 cutthroat trout, so eager for a new home that they walked to the truck across the valley. The final blow came when 4 dozen sandhill cranes arrived, as tall as men and twice as noisy. The chaos of this swamp kept everyone awake every hour of every day. Beatrice had been tasked with driving the animals away. That was when she had discovered the truck beneath it all. Her slow restoration of the truck had evicted the animals so gradually that the new marsh hardly noticed it was being asked to leave. And soon, most of the Soria family did not remember that it had even been there. Even the truck seemed to have been mostly forgotten. Though the wooden planks of the floor were still stained with rust-red circles from paint cans, the only reminder of its time as an ecosystem was an egg Beatrice had found under the gas pedal. It was enormous, hand-sized, mottled like the moon and light as air. She'd made a gauzy hairnet hammock for it and hung it in the back of the truck for luck. Now, it swung to and fro over Korean War transmitters, third-hand tape decks, broken turntables and scavenged tubes, resistors and capacitors. Diablo, 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 crooned, "Next, we're gonna spin a pretty little number by the Drifters. This is Save the Last Dance for Me, but we're not done dancing, so stay tuned." Joaquin did not, in fact, spin a pretty little number by the Drifters, though it did begin to play from one of the tape decks. The entire broadcast had been pre-taped in case the station had to take off in a hurry. The Federal Communications Commission took a dim view of America's youth establishing unlicensed radio stations in their free time, particularly as America's youth seemed to have terrible taste in music and a hankering for revolution. Fines and jail time waited for offenders. "Do you think they might be tracking us?" Joaquin asked hopefully. He did not want to be pursued by the government, but he wanted to be heard, and he longed so badly for the second that he felt it was his duty to assume the first was inevitable. Beatrice had been sitting by the transmitter, fingers hovered vaguely over it, wrapped in her own imagination. When she realized that both Joaquin and Daniel were waiting for her to answer, she said, "Not if the range hasn't improved." Beatrice was the second oldest cousin. Where Joaquin was noisy and colorful, Beatrice was serene and eerie. She was 18 years old, a hippie Madonna with dark hair parted evenly on either side of her face, a nose shaped like a J, and a small enigmatic mouth that men would probably describe as a rosebud, but Beatrice would describe as, "My mouth." She had 9 fingers, as she had cut one of them off by accident when she was 12, but she didn't much mind. It was only a pinky and on her right hand. She was left-handed. At the very least, it had been an interesting experience, and anyway, it wasn't as if she could take it back now. Joaquin was in the box truck station for the glory of it, but Beatrice's involvement was entirely for intellectual gratification. The restoration of the truck and construction of the radio had both been puzzles, and she enjoyed puzzles. She understood puzzles. When she was 3, she had devised a retractable secret bridge from her bedroom window to the horse paddock that allowed her to cross barefoot in the middle of the night without being stabbed by the goat's head burrs that plagued the area. When she was 7, she had devised a cross between a mobile and a puppetry set so she could lie in bed and make the Soria family dolls dance for her. When she was 9, she had begun developing a secret language with her father, Francisco Soria, and they were still perfecting it now, years later. In its written form, it was constructed entirely from strings of numbers. Its spoken form was sung in notes that corresponded to the mathematical formula of the desired sentiment. Here was a thing Beatrice wanted: to devote time to understanding how a butterfly was similar to a galaxy. Here was a thing she feared: being asked to do anything else. "Do you think Mama or Nana are listening?" Joaquin, Diablo Diablo, persisted. He did not want his mother or grandmother to discover his alternate identity, but he longed for them to hear Diablo Diablo and whisper to each other that this pirate DJ sounded both handsome and like Joaquin. "Not if the range hasn't improved," Beatrice repeated. It was a question she had already posed to herself. The signal of their first broadcast had reached only a few hundred meters, despite the large TV antenna she had added to the system. Now, her mind ran along each place the signal might be escaping before it got to the antenna. Joaquin looked surly.
"You don't have to say it like that."
Beatrice did not feel bad. She hadn't said it like anything. She just said it. Sometimes that was not enough, however. Back home at Bicho Raro, they sometimes called her La Chica Sin Sentimientos. Beatrice did not mind being called a girl without feelings. The statement seemed true enough to her.
"Anyway, how could they? We took the radio."
They all peered at the transistor radio pilfered from Antonia Soria's kitchen counter. "Small steps, Joaquin," Daniel advised. "Even a small voice is still a voice." This was the third and oldest cousin in the truck. His given name was Daniel Lupe Soria, and he was 19, and his parents had both been dead for longer than he had been alive. On every knuckle but his thumbs, he had an eye tattoo, so that he had 8 of them like a spider. And he was built a little like a spider, with long limbs and prominent joints and light body. His hair was smooth and straight, down to his shoulders. He was the saint of Bicho Raro, and he was very good at it. Beatrice and Joaquin loved him very much, and he loved them as well. Although he knew of Beatrice and Joaquin's radio project, he had not previously accompanied them, as he was usually very busy with the matter of miracles. As the saint, the coming and going of miracles occupied most of his thoughts and actions, a task he took great pleasure in and greater responsibility for. But tonight, he grappled with a matter of personal importance, and he wanted to spend time with his cousins to remind himself of all the reasons to practice caution. Here was a thing he wanted. To help someone he was not allowed to help. Here was a thing he feared, that he would ruin his entire family because of this private desire.
"Even a small voice is still small," Joaquin countered crossly.
"One day, you will have become famous as Diablo Diablo, and we will be the pilgrims, going to see you in Los Angeles," Daniel said.
"Or at least in Durango," Beatrice revised.
Joaquin preferred imagining a future in Los Angeles to a future in Durango, but he didn't protest further. Their faith was enough for now. In some families, cousin doesn't mean anything. But that wasn't true for this generation of the Sorias. Even as the relationships between the older Sorias rubbed sand into pearls, these 3 Soria cousins remained inseparable. Joaquin was fanciful, but in this truck, they enjoyed his outsized ambition. Beatrice was remote. But in this truck, Daniel and Joaquin did not need anything more from her than what she easily gave. And everyone loved the saint of Bicho Raro. But in this truck, Daniel was able to be simply human.
"Here, I'll check the range now," Beatrice said. "Hand me the radio."
"Hand it yourself,"
Joaquin replied, but Beatrice merely sat quietly until he passed it to her. There was no point trying to wait out Beatrice.
"I'll come with you," Daniel said quickly.
Back in Bicho Raro, there was a pair of twin goats named Fea and Moco, who had been born under notable circumstances. It is common for goats to have twins, and sometimes even triplets, so it was not notable that Fea and Moco were twins. What was unusual was that Moco was born first, and then Fea's mother decided that she did not have the energy or interest in giving birth a second time in the same night.
So although Fea would have been just as happy being born minutes after her twin, she remained in her mother's womb for months, while her mother worked up the motivation to birth again. Finally, Fea was born. Her additional time in the womb, away from the sun, had turned her coat jet black. Although to the outside eye, Fea and Moko appeared to be merely siblings, or even unrelated, the two of them remained as close as twins, always attentive and fond of each other's presence. This was the way it was with Beatriz and Daniel. As close as Joaquin and Beatriz and Daniel were, Beatriz and Daniel were closer still. They were both quiet on the inside and outside, and they both had a hungry curiosity for what made the world work. But there was also the closeness created by the miracles. All of the Sorias were gifted with the ability to perform miracles. But into every generation, there were born a few who were more suited to the task than others. They were stranger or holier than other people, depending upon whom you asked. Daniel and Beatriz were the most saintly at the moment, and as Beatriz wanted desperately to not be the saint, and Daniel wanted little else, balance was achieved. Outside the truck, the cold desert sky pushed up and out and away, a story without ending. Beatriz shivered. Her mother, Antonia, said she had the heart of a lizard, and it was true that she had a reptile's preference for the claustrophobia of heat. Although Beatriz had a flashlight tied up in the hem of her skirt, she didn't retrieve it. She was not remotely worried about the FCC, but she nonetheless did not want to call attention to their location. She had a strong feeling, in the way a Soria does sometimes, that there were miracles afoot, and she had been told, in the way all Sorias are told, that there were consequences for interfering with miracles. So they walked in the near dark. The light of the partial moon was quite sufficient to pick out the silhouettes of spiky bayonet and spindly manzanita and raggedy creosote bushes. Juniper released a damp, warm smell, and Russian thistle tugged at Beatrice's skirt. Far-off light from Alamosa browned the horizon, looking natural from this far away, like a premature sunrise. From the radio, Diablo Diablo said look, said wait, said listen. Here's a single you're not going to believe, a hot little number that hasn't gotten enough play from the big guys. Inside Beatriz Soria's mind, thoughts turned busily, as they always did. As she and Daniel moved through the dark, she thought about the casual ingenuity of the portable radio they carried, and also about a time when people had imagined the night air was full of nothing, and also about the expression, dead air. And now she thought instead about how really she was pushing through a crowded atomic city of invisible chemicals, microorganisms, and waves, the last of them detectable only because she held this magic box, capable of receiving them and spitting them back out for her mortal ears. She leaned into these invisible radio signals as she would a heavy wind, and with one hand she snatched at the air as if she might feel them. This was an impulse that she often had, to touch the invisible. She had learned after years of childhood correction to reserve it for moments when no one else was watching. Daniel did not count as someone else in this regard. But she felt only the slow creep of an approaching miracle. The radio signal had begun to fray. Another station was gulping a syllable here and there. Beatriz? Asked Daniel. His voice sounded a little hollow, a cup with no water in it, a sky without stars. Do you think consequences are meaningful if we haven't seen them for ourselves? Sometimes. When a question is about a secret, people will ask a different but related question, hoping to get an answer that will work for both questions. Beatriz realized at once that this was what Daniel was doing now. She did not know what to do about the fact of his having secrets, but she answered as best as she could. I think an untested consequence is a hypothesis. Do you think I've been a good saint?
This was still not really the question in his mind, and in any case, no one who had spent even a minute in Bichoraro would have possibly spoken against Daniel Lupe Soria's devotion.
You were a better one than I would be.
You could be a fine saint.
The evidence doesn't agree with you.
Where is your science? Daniel asked. One piece of evidence is not science. His tone was lighter now, but Beatrice was not comforted. He was not ordinarily troubled, and she could not forget the sound of it in his voice. Beatrice turned the radio slightly to reduce the crackling.
Some experiments only require one result for proof, or at least to prove it's not responsible to perform them a second time.
Loudening static hung between the two cousins, and eventually Daniel said, "Did you ever think that maybe we're doing it wrong? All of us?" This, finally, was a real question instead of a hidden one, although it was not the real question. But it was too big a puzzle to be answered in only one night. Further conversation was interrupted by a shudder in the shrub before them. It twitched and shivered again, and then a shadow roared out of it. Neither Beatrice nor Daniel flinched. This was because they were Sorias. In their family, if you were going to leap at every shadow that suddenly appeared, you needed to plan on some fine calf muscles. The roar resolved into a great, hushing thud of wings, and the shadow resolved into an enormous bird in flight. It flapped close enough that Beatrice's hair moved against her cheek. An owl. Beatrice knew many things about owls. Owls have enormous and powerful eyes. But these remarkable eyeballs are fixed in place by bony protuberances called sclerotic rings. This is why owls must move their heads in all directions in lieu of flicking their eyes from side to side. Several owl species have asymmetrical ears, which allows them to accurately pinpoint the origin of a sound. Many people do not realize that in addition to possessing powerful vision and hearing, owls are very attracted to miracles, though the mechanism that draws the birds to them is poorly understood. Daniel leaned close to turn off the radio. The quiet hurried around them. On the other side of where the owl had appeared, distant headlights came into view. In a place like this, you could go all night without seeing another vehicle, and so it was with interest that Beatrice watched the two tiny lights travel from right to left. It was far too distant to hear, but she knew the sound of tires on the gravel so well that her ears pretended they caught it. She lifted her hand to see if she could feel the sound with her fingers. Daniel closed his eyes. His mouth moved. He was praying.
"Headlights, are you too stupid?"
Joaquin had grown bored waiting for them to report, and now called to them from the open back of the truck.
"Headlights! Why didn't you say right away? The FCC!"
Beatrice closed her fingers and lowered her hand. She said,
"They aren't headed this way."
"How can you know?"
"They're going to."
She lifted a vague hand and allowed that gesture to serve as the rest of the sentence. Joaquin sprang back inside to rip wires from the battery, then leaped back out and began to tear up ground wires with a great and fearful energy. But Beatrice was right, as she often was. The headlights continued on their distant path without pause, illuminating motionless antelope and clumps of grass. The vehicle was headed unerringly toward Bichoraro. It was hunting not for a radio signal, but for a miracle. Daniel opened his eyes. He said, "I need to get there before they do." There would be no miracle without a saint. Chapter 2. There were two people in the vehicle driving toward Bichoraro that night. Pete Wyatt and Tony DiRisio.
Pete and Tony had run into each other in western Kansas many long hours before. Not literally, but nearly. Pete had been hitchhiking alongside endless prairie, slow-motion counting the mile markers out loud 4 or 5 times an hour, when a big owl flew right overhead, making him jump a few inches. A second later, a car skidded into the space Pete had just been occupying. Tony had rolled down the window, peered through the cloud of dust and gravel, and demanded, "What's my name?" When Pete had confessed that he didn't know, Tony's expression had cleared.
"You'll have to drive," Tony said, unbuckling his seatbelt, "because I'm too high."
This was how Pete, a kid who had driven his father's sedan only a few dozen times since getting his license, found himself piloting an aggressively unattractive Mercury station wagon painted an overdone egg yolk yellow. Tony DiRisio liked large cars. When he'd visited the Philadelphia car dealership to purchase it, he had brought only a tape measure and his checkbook. He felt there was a permanence to a car that was over 17 feet long and covered with wood paneling. Tony himself was handsome as a cigarette. Currently, he wore a white suit and dark sideburns. Both had appeared stylish at one point, but by the time Pete met him, they were rumpled. He had been driving the Mercury for 5 days, and driving himself for longer. He was only 34, but he had lived all of those years twice, once as Tony DiRisio, and once as Tony Triumph. After surviving a childhood too boring to repeat in polite company, he'd become a DJ at an easy-listening station too boring to play in polite company. Over the past few years, he had transformed himself and the station into a household fixture by the expedient of bringing random housewives into the station to play their pick of the hour. He became a hunted man. Philadelphia women now sought him in grocery aisles and on neighborhood sidewalks, hoping to catch his eye. The local rag ran pieces analyzing the type of woman he was likely to invite. What they'd been wearing when discovered, shoes without heels mostly, how they had worn their hair, often in rollers, and how old they'd been, usually over 50. The headline mused, "Does Tony Triumph want his mother?" Here was a thing he wanted. To stop having dreams of being laughed at by tiny birds with very long legs. Here was a thing he feared. People watching him while he ate. He also missed his mother. Pete Wyatt didn't know any of this about Tony. He was not an easy-listening fan, and had never been east of the Mississippi anyway. He was only a few weeks out of high school. A clean-cut fellow, with dull brown hair and bright brown eyes, and reasonably tidy fingernails. Although he was more than a decade younger than Tony, he had been born old, already a good rock to build a church from the moment he first rolled out of his mother. He was one of those folks who couldn't avoid helping. At 12, he'd organized a canned food drive and set a world record for the most pounds of creamed corn ever donated to the poor. At 15, struck by the unspoken misery of being a friendless child, he had saved up enough money to give every first grader in his old school a baby chick. A miscommunication with the newspaper covering the story had resulted in 3 Indiana poultry farms doubling and then tripling and then quadrupling the donations. 2,000 chicks had arrived in Pete's hometown, one for every student in his school system, plus 3 extra. He trained those 3 to do tricks for old folks' homes. Pete had intended to join the military after high school, an army man like his father, but doctors had found a hole in his heart. So the day after he graduated, he'd packed up his shame into a duffel and started hitching from Oklahoma to Colorado. Here was a thing Pete wanted. To start a business that made him feel as good as 2,000 baby chickens. Here was a thing he feared. That this strange feeling in his heart
this palpably growing emptiness, would eventually kill him.
Colorado is a long way from most places. This meant the drive would have been long in any circumstance. But it seemed even longer because Pete and Tony, like a lot of people who were destined to be friends, couldn't stand each other.
"Sir?"
Pete said, rolling down his window several hours after taking the wheel. "Do you think you could give that a rest?"
Tony smoked in the Mercury's passenger seat as the dusty afternoon followed the car. Pete had been looking for road signs to let him know how far they had to go. There were none.
"Kid," Tony said, "do you think you could get that stick out of your ass?"
"If the point of me driving all these miles was 'cause you were too high, and I've been coughing on your smoke for 10 hours, I guess I don't see what the point is then."
Some people find the effects of marijuana calming. Some people find it calms them, but they're offended by its usage. Still others are not offended, but find it makes them anxious. And then, some are both offended and anxious. Pete belonged to this final group.
"You always this pedantic? Why don't you turn on the radio?"
There was no knob. Pete said,
"I can't, the dial's missing."
With satisfaction, Tony replied,
"Damn right it is, because I threw it out the window in Ohio. I didn't want to listen to its whining, and I don't want to listen to yours either. Why don't you just point those lost puppy eyes of yours right out the window and stare at God's country for a while?"
This advice was mixed. If Pete had had something to distract him from the changing landscape, he might not have been as hard struck by it. As it was, after Tony had concluded his smoking and nodded off to sleep, there was only Pete and the great outdoors. Over the course of the day, the landscape ran alongside the car, shifting from plains to hills to mountains to bigger mountains, and then, suddenly, became desert. The kind of desert that is located in that corner of Colorado is a hard one. It is not the painted rocks and elegant cactus pillars one finds farther southwest, nor is it the secretive pine-furred mountains and valleys of the rest of Colorado. It is barren scrub and yellow dust and blue-tinged, sharp-teethed mountains in the distance that want to have nothing to do with you. Pete fell deeply in love with it. This strange, cold desert does not care if you live or die in it, but he fell for it anyway. He had not known before then that a place could feel so raw and so close to the surface. His weak heart felt the danger, but could not resist. He fell in love so fiercely that the desert itself noticed. The desert was accustomed to the casual love affairs of strangers passing through, so it cruelly tested his affection by raising a dust storm. Grit buffeted the vehicle, creeping in through the edges of the windows and drifting in the corners of the dashboard. Pete had to stop to remove tumbleweed and branches from the Mercury's grill and to shake sand from his boots, but his love remained intact. Unconvinced, the desert then encouraged the sun's full power to beat down upon Pete and Tony. The heat in the car climbed from double digits to triple digits. The dash cracked in the sunlight, and the steering wheel grew hot as molten iron under Pete's hands. But as sweat rolled into his collar and his mouth dried out, Pete was still enamored. Then, as the afternoon got old, the jaded desert conjured what little rain it could manage from the sky just north of the Mercury. That rain rolled into a flash flood that dragged sloppy mud across the highway, and in the thin evening light, the desert let the temperature drop suddenly below freezing. The mud froze and thawed and then changed its mind and froze again. All this indecision heaved open a crack in the asphalt, which the Mercury fell into. Tony woke with a start.
"What happened here?"
"Weather," replied Pete.
"I like weather like I like my news," Tony said. "Happening to someone else."
Pete opened the door with some difficulty. The car was at an unnatural angle.
You steer.
He climbed out to push, and Tony put his shoes back on before slithering into the driver's seat. The desert watched as Pete strained to free the mercury from the gap in the road, heaving one shoulder against the rear bumper. The spinning tires sprayed a moist, cold layer of golden dirt onto Pete's legs.
"Are you even pushing, kid?" Tony called out.
"I am, sir."
"Are you sure you're not pulling?"
"We can switch places," Pete offered.
"There's a hell of a gap between can and should," Tony said, "and I'm not eager to close it."
Finally, the mercury broke free. Pete's eyes followed not the vehicle as it trundled forward, but instead the varied and complicated horizon of the desert. The very last of the sun played over it, and every stalk of grass dripped with honeyed light. His back ached, and his arms were pebbled with goosebumps, but as he savored the view and sucked in big, juniper-scented breaths, he was still besotted. The desert, which was not given to sympathy or sentiment, was nonetheless moved, and for the first time in a long time, it loved someone back. It was not until several hours later, after night had fallen, that Pete worked up the nerve to ask Tony where he was headed. Before, it hadn't really mattered. It had been obvious they were both going to be sharing the same path for a while, since they had met up in the part of Kansas that went away only if you kept going west.
"Colorado," said Tony.
"We're in Colorado."
"Near Alamosa."
"We're near Alamosa."
"Beach El Raro," said Tony.
Pete looked at him hard enough that the mercury swerved as well.
"Beach El Raro?"
"Did I stutter, kid?"
"It's just, that's where I'm going, too."
Tony shrugged with only his dense black eyebrows and looked out the window at only the dense black night.
"What?" Pete said. "You don't think that's a coincidence?"
"A coincidence that you don't want to get out and walk in the middle of the desert?" "Yeah. It's a miracle, son."
Because Pete was an honest soul, it took him a long minute to process Tony's meaning.
"Look, sir, I've got the letter from my aunt right in my shirt pocket. You can see it for yourself. I'm heading to Beach El Raro."
He fumbled it out of his pocket as the mercury swerved again. Tony took a gander.
"This is probably your math homework."
It turned out that the sweat of several days of walking by the highway had smeared the last letter Aunt Josefa had written Pete. Tony didn't really care either way, but to Pete the implication that he was anything but truthful, that he was a freeloader, was well nigh unbearable.
"I'm going there for a summer job. My aunt visited there a few years ago. She lives up near Fort Collins now, but back then she was in a... well, I don't know why I would tell you this, but she was in a real bad place, and says they helped her out of it. She wrote me and told me they have a box truck I could have as my own, and they're willing to let me work off the price of it with hard labor."
Tony blew more smoke.
"What the hell do you want with a box truck?"
"I'm going to start a moving company."
As Pete said it, he caught a flash of the logo in his imagination. Wyatt Moving, with a friendly-looking blue ox straining against the yoke.
"You youths get such funny ideas these days."
"It's a fine idea."
"A moving company is what you want out of life."
"It's a fine idea," Pete repeated.
He gripped the wheel and drove in silence for several minutes. The road was arrow straight and the sky was dream black, and every landmark was the same post with barbed wire nailed into it. He could not see the desert, but he knew it was out there still. He could feel that hole in his heart pretty acutely.
"Why are you going to Beach El Raro, then?"
Here was the truth. Every morning before working up the nerve to go into WZIZ for another fun, fresh, friendly broadcast, Tony drove across Philadelphia to Juniata,
and idled near the park there, where he could be surrounded by people who he was certain had no idea who he was. Many folks find this an unpleasant sensation, but for Tony, who felt he lived life under a microscope, it was a relief. For a few minutes he was Tony DiRisio and not Tony Triumph. Then he put the car in drive and went to work. One morning, several weeks before, a woman had knocked on his window. It was raining outside, and she had a grocery bag over her hair to preserve her curls. She was about 50. She was the sort of lady Tony would usually ask to be on his show, but she was no eager housewife. Instead, she told him that her family had talked about it, and they decided he needed to find the Soria family. Tony could see that they were all standing several yards behind her, having sent her as head of household to do the reporting. They knew who he was, she said, and they didn't like to see him like this. The Sorias were no longer in Mexico, so he wouldn't even need to worry about crossing the border. He just needed to start driving his car west and listen for the sound of a miracle in his heart. The Sorias would give him the change he needed. Tony had told the woman that he was fine. Shaking her head, she had given him a handkerchief and patted his cheek before departing. Tony's eyes had been dry, but when he turned the handkerchief over, written upon it in felt pen were the words, Bicho Raro, Colorado. What Tony asked Pete now was,
"You superstitious kid?"
"I'm a Christian," Pete said dutifully. Tony laughed.
"I knew a guy who used to tell all kinds of hair-raising stories about staying out here in this valley. Said there was always strange lights, flying saucers maybe. Said there were mothmen and skinwalkers and all kinds of critters out here walking at night. Pterodactyls. Trucks. You're absolutely no fun."
"No, there." Pete pointed.
"Doesn't that look like a truck parked over there?"
Although Pete didn't know it, he was pointing at the very box truck that he had come all this way to earn,
the box truck that was currently holding the Soria cousins, including the one he was going to fall in love with. As he squinted to see more, the rear door of the truck closed and the light went out. In the resulting blackness, Pete wasn't sure he'd seen anything at all.
"Lizard men," Tony said.
"Probably."
But Tony had glimpsed something as well. Not outside of himself, but rather inside. A curious tug. He remembered suddenly what the woman had said about listening for miracles. Only listening wasn't exactly what he was doing right now. He didn't hear anything. He wasn't intercepting a sound or a song. His ears weren't doing any work. It was a mysterious part of him that he had not used before this night, and would never use again after. Tony said,
"I think we're almost there."
Chapter 3 Bicho Raro was a place of strange miracles. When the mercury scoffed into the compound, dust bloomed and died around the bumper as it lurched to a stop. The egg-colored station wagon sat among an odd collection of cabins and tents and barns and houses and sagging barns circled close to one another. Dead cars run adrift in barbed wire, and rusting appliances sinking into the banks of the feeble water share. Most of it faded into invisibility in the night. A sole porch light shone from one of the houses. Shadows darted and fluttered around it, looking like moths or birds. They were not moths or birds. Before the Sorias, Bicho Raro had been barely anything at all. Just the elbow end of a massive cattle ranch that had more in the way of fields and less in the way of cattle. This was before the Sorias had left Mexico, before the Revolution, back when they'd been called Los Santos de Abejones. When they'd been Los Santos de Abejones, hundreds of pilgrims had come to them for blessings and healings,
camping outside tiny abejones for miles, right up into the mountains. Merchants had sold prayer cards and charms on the road to those who waited. Legends had crept out of the town, carried on horseback, and tucked in people's satchels and written into ballads played in bars late at night. Amazing transformations and terrifying deeds. It did not seem to matter if the stories were good or bad. As long as they were interesting, they drew a crowd. The impassioned crowd had christened babies after Los Santos and had raised armies in their name. The Mexican government at the time hadn't thought much of this, and they told the Sorias they could either stop performing miracles or start praying for one to save them. The Sorias had turned to the church for support, but the Catholic Church at the time hadn't thought much of the dark miracles and had also told them they could either stop performing miracles or start praying for one to save them. But the Sorias were born to be saints. They'd marched out of Mexico under the cover of darkness and had kept walking until they'd found another mountain-edged place, quiet enough to let miracles be heard. That was the story of Bicho Raro.
"This is it, kid," Tony said, and climbed out of the Mercury with some of his usual swagger restored.
There is a certain confidence to coming to the end of a 2,000-mile road trip, however uncertain the next beginning might be. Pete remained behind the wheel, his window rolled down. He was reticent for two reasons. For starters, his experience in Oklahoma had told him that places like this were often populated by unleashed dogs, and although he was not properly afraid of dogs, he had been bitten by one as a younger child, and had since preferred to avoid situations where large mammals ran directly at him. And also, he saw now that Bicho Raro was not a proper town, as he thought it would be. There would be no motor inn where he could stay the night, and no easily accessible telephone with which to contact his aunt.
"You're going to have to get out of that car eventually," Tony told him. "I thought this was where you were headed. Both going to the same place, you said. Believe me, my aunt told me to keep walking until I found a Mercury, you said. You calling me a liar, sir? This is the place."
That was when the dogs burst out. Sometimes, when dogs emerge at farms, people come out afterward with reassuring statements about how the dogs' barks are worse than their bites, how they look savage but are kittens at heart. Wouldn't hurt a fly. Members of the family, really. Visitors are comforted by the knowledge, then, that these dogs are kept mostly for their alarm purposes and to frighten away large predators. No one would say that about the dogs at Bicho Raro. There were six of them, and although they were littermates, they were six different colors and sizes and shapes, all of them ugly. They were meant to be 12 of them, but these six were so bad-tempered that in the womb they'd eaten the other six. They were so bad-tempered that when they'd been born, their mother had lost patience with them and abandoned them under a parade float in Farmington. There, a tender-hearted long-haul trucker had scooped them into a box to raise them to weaning age. They were so bad-tempered that he took up drinking before leaving them in a ditch near Pagosa Springs. A pack of coyotes tried to eat them there, but the puppies learned how to walk and then run and turned on the coyotes, chasing them nearly all the way to Bicho Raro. That was when Antonia Soria, Beatrice's mother, had found them and taken them home. They were still bad-tempered, but so was she, and they loved her. Tony stood his ground for a hot minute. Pete rolled up his window. Antonia Soria's six dogs snarled and circled, their hackles up and their teeth bared. They hadn't killed a man yet, but the yet was displayed prominently in their expressions. This was how Tony came to be on the roof of the Mercury when the lights of Bicho Raro began to flicker on. Now that the lights were coming on, it was obvious that there were owls everywhere. There were horned owls and elf owls,
long-eared owls and short-eared owls, barn owls with their ghostly ladies' faces, and screech owls with their shaggy frowns, dark-eyed barred owls and spotted owls, Stygian owls with eyes that turned red in lights at night. These owls weren't originally from Colorado, but like the Soria family, they had come from Oaxaca to Bicho Raro and decided to stay. The dogs were trying to get on the hood of the car to reach Tony. Pete activated the windshield wiper spray to repel them.
"You're a real war hero," Tony snarled. One of the dogs ate his left shoe. "I could just drive us out of here," Pete said. "You could hold on."
"Boy, don't even think about turning that key."
"Are you sure this is it?" Pete asked.
"Damn pelicans," Tony said.
The promise of a miracle was rolling off him thick now, and the owls were swirling down low over the top of the Mercury. From Tony's vantage point on the roof, he could see a row of small elf owls sitting on the roof of one of the metal-sided garages. They had big eyes and long legs, and although they were not laughing at him, he was close enough for Tony's skin to crawl. From the safety of the driver's seat, Pete looked for signs of human life. He found himself looking at someone who was looking back. A girl stood watching him from the porch of a small cabin. She wore a beautiful wedding dress and a very sad face. Her dark hair was pulled back into a smooth bun at the base of her neck. Her dress was wet, and so was her skin. This was because, despite the porch roof, it was raining on her. Rain originated from nowhere and spattered on her hair and face and shoulders and clothing, then ran off the stairs and formed a fast-running rivulet into the brush. Every part of her dress was covered with monarch butterflies, their orange and black stained-glass wings likewise soaked. They clung to her, unable to do anything but slowly move their wings or climb across the fabric. Butterflies are fragile flyers and cannot fly in the rain, or even in the dew. Too much water makes their wings too heavy to fly. This was Maricita Lopez, one of the pilgrims. It had stormed around her ever since she had experienced her first miracle, and now rain constantly poured on her head and out of her eyes. It was not as beatific as one might imagine to live under continuous precipitation in a desert. The ground, instead of enjoying the sudden influx of moisture, was ill-prepared to accept it. The water pooled and ran away, striking down seedlings in its path. Floods, not flowers, followed in Maricita's wake. Here was a thing she wanted, to taste vanilla without crying. Here was a thing she feared, that the prettiest thing about her was her exterior. Pete didn't know it to look at her, but she had been preparing to make a terrible decision directly before they'd arrived. Now she could not act until the night had quieted again. Rolling down his window, he called, "Can you help us?" But Maricita, absorbed in her own dark night, withdrew into the building behind her. He called again.
"Is there anyone out there?"
There were. There were aunts and uncles and grandmothers and cousins and babies. But none of them wanted to welcome the pilgrims. It was not that they wanted to refuse these newcomers a miracle. It was simply that every bed was already full. Bicho Raro was brimming with pilgrims who couldn't move on. And since the Sorias could not offer a room, there was only the miracle to attend to. Daniel would handle it, and the rest of them wouldn't have to leave their warm homes or risk any contact with the pilgrims. At that moment, however, Daniel was creeping back to the shrine while Beatriz and Joaquin remained in the truck with the radio, trying to time their own return in such a way that it would not raise questions. Because of this, Tony and Pete might have spent quite a long time on top of and inside the Mercury, if not for the fortuitous arrival of another vehicle. The rescuers were Judith, Beatrice's older sister,
and Judith's new husband, Eduardo Costa, coming down from Colorado Springs. Eduardo was driving his brand-new Chevy Stepside pickup truck. The general agreement was that Eduardo loved the truck more than Judith.